This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Never Never, Part 1, written by Taryn Fisher and Colleen Hoover, performed by Elizabeth Evans and Kevin Free.
Chapter 1. Charlie. A crash. Books fall to the speckled linoleum floor. They skid a few feet, whirling in circles, and stop near feet. My feet. I don't recognize the black sandals or the red toenails, but they move when I tell them to, so they must be mine. Right? A bell rings. Shrill. I jump, my heart racing. My eyes move left to right as I scope out my environment, trying not to give myself away. What kind of bell was that? Where am I? Kids with backpacks walk briskly into the room, talking and laughing. A school bell. They slide into desks, their voices competing in volume. I see movement at my feet and jerk in surprise. Someone is bent over, gathering up books on the floor, a red-faced girl with glasses. Before she stands up, she looks at me with something like fear and then scurries off. People are laughing. When I look around, I think they're laughing at me. But it's the girl with glasses they're looking at. Charlie! Someone calls. Didn't you see that? And then, Charlie? What's your problem? Hello? My heart is beating fast. So fast. Where is this? Why can't I remember? Charlie! Someone hisses. I look around. Who is Charlie? Which one is Charlie? There are so many kids. Blonde hair, ratty hair, brown hair, glasses, no glasses. A man walks in carrying a briefcase. He sets it on the desk. The teacher. I am in a classroom, and that is the teacher. High school or college, I wonder. I stand up suddenly. I'm in the wrong place. Everyone is sitting, but I'm standing, walking.
Where are you going, Miss Winwood?
The teacher is looking at me over the rim of his glasses as he rifles through a pile of papers. He slaps them down hard on the desk, and I jump. I must be Miss Winwood.
She has cramps,
someone calls out. People snicker. I feel a chill creep up my back and crawl across the tops of my arms. They're laughing at me, except I don't know who these people are. I hear a girl's voice say, "Shut up, Michael." I don't know, I say, hearing my voice for the first time. It's too high. I clear my throat and try again. I don't know. I'm not supposed to be here. There is more laughing. I glance around at the posters on the wall, the faces of presidents animated with dates beneath them. History class? High school? The man, the teacher, tilts his head to the side like I've said the dumbest thing.
And where else are you supposed to be on test day?
I don't know.
Sit down,
he says. I don't know where I'd go if I left. I turn around to go back. The girl with the glasses glances up at me as I pass her. She looks away almost as quickly. As soon as I'm sitting, the teacher starts handing out papers. He walks between desks, his voice a flat drone as he tells us what percentage of our final grade the test will be. When he reaches my desk, he pauses, a deep crease between his eyebrows.
I don't know what you're trying to pull.
He presses the tip of a fat pointer finger on my desk.
Whatever it is, I'm sick of it. One more stunt, and I'm sending you to the principal's office.
He slaps the test down in front of me and moves down the line. I don't nod. I don't do anything. I'm trying to decide what to do. Announce to the whole room that I have no idea who and where I am, or pull him aside and tell him quietly. He said no more stunts. My eyes move to the paper in front of me. People are already bent over their tests, pencils scratching. Fourth period. History. Mr. Dulcott. There is a space for a name. I'm supposed to write my name, but I don't know what my name is. Miss Winwood, he called me,
Why don't I recognize my own name? Or where I am? Or what I am? Every head has bent over their papers except mine. So I sit and stare straight ahead. Mr. Delcott glares at me from his desk. The longer I sit, the redder his face becomes. Time passes, and yet my world has stopped. Eventually, Mr. Delcott stands up, his mouth open to say something to me, when the bell rings.
"Put your papers on my desk on the way out,"
he says, his eyes still on my face. Everyone is filing out of the door. I stand up and follow them because I don't know what else to do. I keep my eyes on the floor, but I can feel his rage. I don't understand why he's so angry with me. I'm in a hallway now, lined on either side by blue lockers.
"Charlie!" someone calls. "Charlie, wait up!"
A second later, an arm loops through mine. I expect it to be the girl with the glasses. I don't know why. It's not. But I know now that I am Charlie. Charlie Winwood.
"You forgot your bag,"
she says, handing over a white backpack. I take it from her, wondering if there's a wallet with a driver's license inside. She keeps her arm looped through mine as we walk. She's shorter than me, with long dark hair and dewy brown eyes that take up half her face. She is startling and beautiful.
"Why were you acting so weird in there?"
she asks.
"You knocked the shrimp's books on the floor and then spaced out."
I can smell her perfume. It's familiar and too sweet, like a million flowers competing for attention. I think of the girl with the glasses, the look on her face as she bent to scoop up her books. If I did that, why don't I remember?
It's lunch. Why are you walking that way?
She pulls me down a different corridor, past more students. They all look at me, little glances. I wonder if they know me, and why I don't know me. I don't know why I don't tell her, tell Mr. Delcott, grab someone random and tell them that I don't know who or where I am. By the time I'm seriously entertaining the idea, we're through a set of double doors in the cafeteria. Noise and color. Bodies that all have a unique smell. Bright fluorescent lights that make everything look ugly. Oh, God. I clutch at my shirt. The girl on my arm is babbling. Andrew this, Marcy that. She likes Andrew and hates Marcy. I don't know who either of them is. She corrals me to the food line. We get salad and Diet Cokes. Then we are sliding our trays on a table. There are already people sitting there. 4 boys, 2 girls. I realize we are completing a group with even numbers. All the girls are matched with a guy. Everyone looks up at me expectantly, like I'm supposed to say something, do something. The only place left to sit is next to a guy with dark hair. I sit slowly, both hands flat on the table. His eyes dart toward me, and then he bends over his tray of food. I can see the finest beads of sweat on his forehead, just below his hairline.
"You two are so awkward sometimes,"
says a new girl, blonde, across from me. She's looking from me to the guy I'm sitting next to. He looks up from his macaroni, and I realize he's just moving things around on his plate. He hasn't taken a bite, despite how busy he looks. He looks at me, and I look at him. Then we both look back at the blonde girl.
"Did something happen that we should know about?"
she asks.
"No,"
we say in unison. "He's my boyfriend. I know by the way they're treating us." He suddenly smiles at me with his brilliantly white teeth and reaches to put an arm around my shoulders.
"We're all good,"
he says, squeezing my arm. I automatically stiffen, but when I see the 6 sets of eyes on my face, I lean in and play along. It's frightening not knowing who you are. Even more frightening thinking you'll get it wrong. I'm scared now. Really scared. It's gone too far. If I say something now, I'll look crazy. His affection seems to make everyone relax. Everyone except him. They go back to talking, but all the words blend together. Football, a party, more football. The guy sitting next to me laughs and joins in with their conversation,
his arm never straying from my shoulders. They call him Silas. They call me Charlie. The dark-haired girl with the big eyes is Annika. I forget everyone else's names in the noise. Lunch is finally over, and we all get up. I walk next to Silas, or rather he walks next to me. I have no idea where I'm going. Annika flanks my free side, winding her arms through mine and chatting about cheerleading practice. She's making me feel claustrophobic. When we reach an annex in the hallway, I lean over and speak to her so only she can hear. "Can you walk me to my next class?" Her face becomes serious. She breaks away to say something to her boyfriend, and then our arms are looped again. I turn to Silas. "Annika is going to walk me to my next class."
"Okay,"
he says. He looks relieved.
"I'll see you later."
He heads off in the opposite direction. Annika turns to me as soon as he's out of sight. "Where's he going?" I shrug. "To class." She shakes her head like she's confused. "I don't get you guys. One day you're all over each other, the next you're acting like you can't stand to be in the same room. You really need to make a decision about him, Charlie." She stops outside a doorway. "This is me," I say, to see if she'll protest. She doesn't. "Call me later," she says. "I want to know about last night." I nod. When she disappears into the sea of faces, I step into the classroom. I don't know where to sit, so I wander to the back row and slide into a seat by the window. I'm early, so I open my backpack. There's a wallet wedged between a couple of notebooks and a makeup bag. I pull it out and flip it open to reveal a driver's license with a picture of a beaming, dark-haired girl. Me. Charlize Margaret Windwood, 2417 Whole Court Way, New Orleans, L.A. I'm 17. My birthday is March 21st. I live in Louisiana. I study the picture in the top left corner, and I don't recognize the face. It's my face, but I've never seen it. I'm pretty. I only have $28. The seats are filling up. The one beside me stays empty, almost like everyone is too afraid to sit there. I'm in Spanish class. The teacher is pretty and young. Her name is Mrs. Cardona. She doesn't look at me like she hates me, like so many other people are looking at me. We start with tenses. I have no past. I have no past. 5 minutes into class, the door opens. Silas walks in, his eyes downcast. I think he's here to tell me something, or to bring me something. I brace myself, ready to pretend, but Mrs. Cardona comments jokingly about his lateness. He takes the only available seat next to me and stares straight ahead. I stare at him. I don't stop staring at him until finally he turns his head to look at me. A line of sweat rolls down the side of his face. His eyes are wide. Wide. Just like mine.
Chapter 2. Silas. 3 hours. It's been almost 3 hours, and my mind is still in a haze. No, not a haze. Not even a dense fog. It feels as if I'm wandering around in a pitch-black room, searching for the light switch. "You okay?" Charlie asks. I've been staring at her for several seconds, attempting to regain some semblance of familiarity from a face that should apparently be the most familiar to me. Nothing. She looks down at her desk, and her thick, black hair falls between us like blinders. I want a better look at her. I need something to grab me, something familiar. I want to predict a birthmark or a freckle on her before I see it, because I need something recognizable. I'll grasp at any piece of her that might convince me I'm not losing my mind. She reaches her hand up, finally, and tucks her hair behind her ear. She looks up at me through two wide and completely unfamiliar eyes. The crease between her brows deepens, and she begins biting at the pad of her thumb. She's worried about me. About us, maybe. Us. I want to ask her if she knows what might have happened to me, but I don't want to scare her. How do I explain that I don't know her? How do I explain this to anyone? I spent the last 3 hours trying to act natural. At first, I was convinced I must have used some kind of illegal substance that caused me to black out, but this is different from blacking out. This is different from being high or drunk, and I have no idea how I even know that. I don't remember anything beyond 3 hours ago. Hey. Charlie reaches out like she's going to touch me, then draws back. Are you okay? I grip the sleeve of my shirt and wipe the sheen of moisture off my forehead. When she glances back up at me, I see the concern still filling her eyes. I force my lips to form a smile. I'm fine, I mutter. Long night. As soon as I say it, I cringe. I have no idea what kind of night I had, and if this girl sitting across from me really is my girlfriend, then a sentence like that probably isn't very reassuring. I see a small twitch in her eye, and she tilts her head. Why was it a long night? Shit. Silas? The voice comes from the front of the room. I look up. No talking, the teacher says. She returns to her instruction, not too concerned with my reaction to being singled out. I glance back at Charlie briefly, and then immediately stare down at my desk. My fingers trace over names carved into the wood. Charlie is still staring at me, but I don't look at her. I flip my hand over, and I run 2 fingers over the calluses across the inside of my palm. Do I work? Mow lawns for a living? Maybe it's from football. During lunch, I decided to use my time to observe everyone around me, and I learned I have football practice this afternoon. I have no idea what time or where, but I've somehow made it through the last few hours without knowing when or where I'm supposed to be. I may not have any sort of recollection right now, but I'm learning that I'm very good at faking it. Too good, maybe. I flip my other hand over and find the same rough calluses on that palm. Maybe I live on a farm. No, I don't. I don't know how I know, but even without being able to recall anything, I seem to have an immediate sense of what assumptions of mine are accurate and which are not. It could just be process of elimination rather than intuition or memory. For example, I don't feel like someone who lives on a farm would be wearing the clothes I have on. Nice clothes. Trendy? Looking down at my shoes, if someone asked me if I have rich parents, I'd tell them, yes, I do. And I don't know how, because I don't remember my parents. I don't know where I live, who I live with, or if I look more like my mother or my father. I don't even know what I look like. I stand abruptly, shoving the desk a few loud inches forward in the process. Everyone in the class turns to face me other than Charlie, because she hasn't stopped staring at me since I sat down. Her eyes aren't inquisitive or kind. Her eyes are accusing. The teacher glares at me, but doesn't seem at all surprised by the loss of everyone's attention to me. She just stands, complacent, waiting for me to announce my reason for the sudden disruption. I swallow. Bathroom. My lips are sticky, my mouth is dry, my mind is wrecked. I don't wait for permission before I begin to head in that direction. I can feel everyone's stares as I push through the door. I go right and make it to the end of the hall without finding a restroom. I backtrack and pass by my classroom door, continuing until I round the corner and find the restroom. I push open the door, hoping for solitude, but someone is standing at the urinal with his back to me. I turn to the sink, but don't look into the mirror. I stare down at the sink, placing my hands on either side of it, gripping tightly. I inhale. If I would just look at myself, my reflection could trigger a memory. Or maybe just give me a small sense of recognition. Something. Anything. The guy who was standing at the urinal seconds before is now standing next to me, leaning against a sink with his arms folded. When I glance over at him, he's glaring at me. His hair is so blonde it's almost white. His skin is so pale it reminds me of a jellyfish. Translucent, almost. I can remember what jellyfish look like, but I have no idea what I'll find when I look at myself in the mirror. You look like shit, Nash. He says with a smirk. Nash? Everyone else has been calling me Silas. Nash must be my last name. I would check my wallet, but there isn't one in my pocket, just a wad of cash. A wallet is one of the first things I looked for after, well, after it happened. Not feeling too hot, I grumble in response. For a few seconds, the guy doesn't respond. He just continues to stare at me the same way Charlie was staring at me in class, but with less concern and way more contentment. The guy smirks and pushes off the sink. He stands up straight, but is still about an inch shy of reaching my height. He takes a step forward, and I gather by the look in his eye that he isn't closing in on me out of concern for my health. We still haven't settled Friday night, the guy says to me. Is that why you're here now? His nostrils flare when he speaks and his hands drop to his sides, clenching and unclenching twice. I have a 2-second silent debate with myself, aware that if I step away from him, it'll make me look like a coward. However, I'm also aware that if I step forward, I'll be challenging him to something I don't want to deal with right now. He obviously has issues with me and whatever it was that I chose to do Friday night that pissed him off. I compromise by giving him no reaction whatsoever. Look unaffected. I lazily move my attention to the sink and turn one of the knobs until a stream of water begins to pour from the faucet. Save it for the field, I say. I immediately want to take back those words. I hadn't considered he might not even play football. I assumed he did, based on his size, but if he doesn't, my comment will have not made a damn bit of sense. I hold my breath and wait for him to correct me or call me out. Neither of those things happens. He stares for a few more seconds and then he shoulders past me, purposefully bumping me on his way out the door. I cup my hands under the stream of water and take a sip. I wipe my mouth with the back of my hand and glance up. At myself. At Silas Nash. What the hell kind of name is that anyway? I'm staring, emotionless, into a pair of unfamiliar, dark eyes. I feel as though I'm staring at two eyes I've never seen before, despite the fact that I've more than likely looked at these eyes on a daily basis since I was old enough to reach a mirror. I'm as familiar with this person in the reflection as I am with the girl who is, according to some guy named Andrew, the girl I've been banging for 2 years now. I'm as familiar with this person in the reflection as I am with every single aspect of my life right now, which is not familiar at all. Who are you? I whisper to him. The bathroom door begins to open, slowly, and my eyes move from my reflection to the reflection of the door. A hand appears, gripping the door. I recognize the sleek red polish on the tips of her fingers. The girl I've been banging for more than 2 years. Silas? I stand up straight and turn to face the door full on as she peeks around it. When her eyes meet mine, it's only for 2 seconds. She glances away, scanning the rest of the bathroom. It's just me, I say. She nods and makes it the rest of the way through the door, albeit extremely hesitant. I wish I knew how to reassure her that everything is okay so she won't grow suspicious. I also wish I remembered her or anything about our relationship, because I want to tell her. I need to tell her. I need for someone else to know so that I can ask questions. But how does a guy tell his girlfriend he has no idea who she is? Who he himself is? He doesn't tell her. He pretends, just like he's been pretending with everyone else. 100 silent questions fill her eyes at once, and I immediately want to dodge them all. I'm fine, Charlie. I smile at her, because it feels like something I should do. Just not feeling so hot. Go back to class. She doesn't move. She doesn't smile. She stays where she is, unaffected by my instruction. She reminds me of one of those animals on springs you'd ride on a playground. The kind you push, but they just bounce right back up. I feel like if someone were to shove her shoulders, she'd lean straight back, feet in place, and then bounce right back up again. I don't remember what those things are called, but I do make a mental note that I somehow remember them. I've made a lot of mental notes in the last 3 hours. I'm a senior. My name is Silas. Nash might be my last name. My girlfriend's name is Charlie. I play football. I know what jellyfish look like. Charlie tilts her head and the corner of her mouth twitches slightly. Her lips part, and for a moment, all I hear are nervous breaths. When she finally forms words, I want to hide from them. I want to tell her to close her eyes and count to 20 until I'm too far away to hear her question.
What's my last name, Silas?
Her voice is like smoke, soft and wispy, and then gone. I can't tell if she's extremely intuitive or if I'm doing a horrible job of covering up the fact that I know nothing. For a moment, I debate whether or not I should tell her. If I tell her and she believes me, she might be able to answer a lot of questions I have. But if I tell her and she doesn't believe me... Babe, I say with a dismissive laugh. Do I call her babe? What kind of question is that? She lifts the foot I was positive was stuck to the floor, and she takes a step forward. She takes another. She continues toward me until she's about a foot away, close enough that I can smell her. Lilies. She smells like lilies. And I don't know how I can possibly remember what lilies smell like, but somehow not remember the actual person standing in front of me who smells like them. Her eyes haven't left mine, not even once.
Silas, she says, what's my last name?
I work my jaw back and forth and then turn around to face the sink again. I lean forward and grip it tightly with both hands. I slowly lift my eyes until they meet hers in the reflection.
Your last name.
My mouth is dry again and my words come out scratchy. She waits. I look away from her and back at the eyes of the unfamiliar guy in the mirror. I can't remember. She disappears from the reflection, followed immediately by a loud smack. It reminds me of the sound the fish make at Pike's Place Market, where they toss and catch them in the wax paper.
Smack!
I spin around and she's lying on the tile floor, eyes closed, arms splayed out. I immediately kneel down and lift her head, but as soon as I have her elevated several inches off the floor, her eyelids begin to flutter open. Charlie? She sucks in a rush of air and sits up. She pulls herself out of my arms and shoves me away, almost as if she's afraid of me. I keep my hands positioned near her in case she attempts to stand, but she doesn't. She remains seated on the floor with her palms pressed into the tile. You passed out, I tell her. She frowns at me.
I'm aware of that.
I don't speak again. I should probably know what all her expressions mean, but I don't. I don't know if she's scared or angry or...
I'm confused, she says, shaking her head. Can you...
She pauses, and then makes an attempt to stand. I stand with her, but I can tell she doesn't like this by the way she glares at my hands that are slightly lifted, waiting to catch her should she start to fall again. She takes two steps away from me and crosses an arm over her chest. She brings her opposite hand up and begins chewing on the pad of her thumb again. She studies me quietly for a moment and then pulls her thumb from her mouth, making a fist.
You didn't know we had class together after lunch.
Her words are spoken with a layer of accusation.
You don't know my last name.
I shake my head, admitting to the two things I can't deny.
What can you remember?
She asks. She's scared, nervous, suspicious. Our emotions are reflections of one another, and that's when the clarity hits. She may not feel familiar. I may not feel familiar, but our actions, our demeanor, they're exactly the same.
What do I remember?
I repeat her question in an attempt to buy myself a few more seconds to allow my suspicions to gain footing. She waits for my answer. History, I say, attempting to remember as far back as I can. Books. I saw a girl drop her books. I grab my neck again and squeeze.
Oh, God.
She takes a quick step toward me.
That's the first thing I remember.
My heart jumps to my throat. She begins to shake her head.
I don't like this. It doesn't make sense.
She appears calm. Calmer than I feel. Her voice is steady. The only fear I see is in the stretched whites of her eyes. I pull her to me without thinking, but I think it's more for my own relief rather than to put her at ease. She doesn't pull away.
And for a second, I wonder if this is normal for us. I wonder if we're in love. I tighten my hold until I feel her stiffen against me. We need to figure this out, she says, separating herself from me. My first instinct is to tell her it'll be okay, that I'll figure it out. I'm flooded with an overwhelming need to protect her, only I have no idea how to do that when we're both experiencing the same reality. The bell rings, signaling the end of Spanish. Within seconds, the bathroom door will probably open, lockers will be slamming shut, we'll have to figure out what classes we're supposed to be in next. I take her hand and pull her behind me as I push open the bathroom door. Where are we going? She asks. I look at her over my shoulder and shrug. I have no idea. I just know I want to leave.
Chapter 3. Charlie. This dude, this guy, Silas, he grabs my hand like he knows me and drags me behind him like I'm a little kid. And that's what I feel like. A little kid in a big, big world. I don't understand anything, and I most certainly don't recognize anything. All I can think, as he pulls me through the understated halls of some anonymous high school, is that I fainted, keeled over like some damsel in distress, and on the boys' bathroom floor. Filthy. I'm evaluating my priorities, wondering how my brain can fit germs into the equation when I clearly have a much larger problem, when we burst into the sunlight. I shield my eyes with my free hand as the Silas dude pulls keys from his backpack. He holds them above his head and makes a circle, clicking the alarm button on his key fob. From some far corner of the parking lot, we hear the shriek of an alarm. We run for it, our shoes slapping the concrete with urgency, as if someone is chasing us. And they might be. The car turns out to be an SUV. I know it's impressive because it sits above the other cars, making them look small and insignificant. A Land Rover. Silas is either driving his dad's car or floating in his dad's money. Maybe he doesn't have a dad. He wouldn't be able to tell me anyway. And how do I even know how much a car like this costs? I have memories of how things work. A car, the rules of the road, the presidents. But not of who I am. He opens the door for me while looking over his shoulder toward the school, and I get the feeling I'm being pranked. He could be responsible for this. He could have given me something to cause me to lose my memory temporarily, and now he's only pretending. Is this for real? I ask, suspended above the front seat. You don't know who you are?
No, he says. I don't.
I believe him. Kind of. I sink into my seat. He searches my eyes for a moment longer before slamming my door and running around to the driver's side. I feel rough, like after a night of drinking. Do I drink? My license said I was only 17. I chew on my thumb as he climbs in and starts the engine by pressing a button. How do you know how to do that? I ask.
Do what?
Start the car without a key?
I don't know.
I watch his face as we pull out of the spot. He blinks a lot, glances at me more, runs a tongue over his bottom lip. When we're at a stoplight, he finds the home button on the GPS and hits it. I'm impressed that he thought to do that. Redirecting, a woman's voice says. I want to lose it, jump out of the moving car and run like a frightened deer. I am so afraid. His home is large. There are no cars in the driveway as we linger on the curb, the engine purring quietly. Are you sure this is you? I ask.
He shrugs. Doesn't look like anyone is home, he says. Should we?
I nod. I shouldn't be hungry, but I am. I want to go inside and have something to eat. Maybe research our symptoms and see if we've come in contact with some brain-eating bacteria that's stolen our memories. A house like this should have a couple of laptops lying around. Silas turns into the driveway and parks. We climb out timidly, looking around at the shrubs and trees like they're going to come alive. He finds a key on his keyring that opens the front door. As I stand behind him and wait, I study him, In his clothes and hair, he wears the cool look of a guy who doesn't care, but he carries his shoulders like he cares too much. He also smells like the outside, grass and pine and rich black dirt. He's about to turn the knob. Wait! He turns around slowly, despite the urgency in my voice. What if there's someone in there? He grins, or maybe it's a grimace.
Maybe they can tell us what the hell is happening.
Then we are inside. We stand immobile for a minute, looking around. I cower behind Silas like a wimp. It's not cold, but I'm shivering. Everything is heavy and impressive. The furniture, the air, my book bag, which hangs off my shoulder like dead weight. Silas moves forward. I grab onto the back of his shirt as we skirt through the foyer and into the family room. We move from room to room, stopping to examine the photos on the walls. Two smiling, sun-kissed parents with their arms around two smiling, dark-haired boys. The ocean in the background. You have a little brother, I say. Did you know you have a little brother? He shakes his head no. The smiling in the photos becomes more scarce as Silas and his mini-me brother get older. There is plenty of acne and braces, photos of parents who are trying too hard to be cheerful, as they pull stiff-shouldered boys toward them. We move to the bedrooms, the bathrooms. We pick up books, read the labels on brown prescription bottles we find in medicine cabinets. His mother keeps dried flowers all over the house, pressed into the books on her nightstand, in her makeup drawer, and lined up on the shelves in their bedroom. I touch each one, whispering their names under my breath. I remember all the names of the flowers. For some reason, this makes me giggle. Silas stops short when he walks into his parents' bathroom and finds me bent over laughing. I'm sorry, I say. I had a moment.
What kind of moment?
A moment where I realized that I've forgotten everything in the world about myself, but I know what a hyacinth is. He nods.
Yeah.
He looks down at his hands, creases forming on his forehead.
Do you think we should tell someone? Go to a hospital, maybe?
Do you think they'd believe us? I ask. We stare at each other then, and I hold back the urge once again to ask if I'm being pranked. This isn't a prank. It's too real. We move to his father's study next, scouring over papers and looking in drawers. There is nothing to tell us why we are like this, nothing out of the ordinary. I keep a close watch on him from the corner of my eye. If this is a prank, he's a very good actor. Maybe this is an experiment, I think. I'm part of some psychological government experiment and I'm going to wake up in a lab. Silas watches me, too. I see his eyes darting over me, wondering, assessing. We don't speak much, just look at this, or do you think this is something? We are strangers, and there are few words between us. Silas's room is last. He clutches my hand as we enter, and I let him, because I'm starting to feel lightheaded again. The first thing I see is a photo of us on his desk. I am wearing a costume, a too-short leopard print tutu and black angel wings that spread elegantly behind me. My eyes are lined with thick, glittery lashes. Silas is dressed in all white, with white angel wings. He looks handsome. Good versus evil, I think. Is that the sort of life game we played? He glances at me and raises his eyebrows. Poor costume choice, I shrug. He cracks a smile, and then we move to opposite sides of the room. I lift my eyes to walls where there are framed photos of people. A homeless man slouched against a wall, holding a blanket around himself. A woman sitting on a bench, crying into her hands. A gypsy, her hand clamped around her own neck as she looks into the camera lens with empty eyes. The photos are morbid. They make me want to turn away, feel ashamed. I don't understand why anyone would want to take a photo of such morbidly sad things, never mind hang them on their walls to look at every day. And then I turn and see the expensive camera perched on the desk. It's in a place of honor, sitting atop a pile of glossy photography books. I look over to where Silas is also studying the photos. An artist. Is this his work? Is he trying to recognize it? No point in asking. I move on. Look at his clothes. Look in the drawers in the rich mahogany desk. I'm so tired. I make to sit down in the desk chair, but he's suddenly animated, beckoning me over. "Look at this," he says. I get up slowly and walk to his side. He's staring down at his unmade bed. His eyes are bright and, should I say, shocked. I follow them to his sheets. And then my blood runs cold. Oh, my God.
Chapter 4. Silas. I toss the comforter out of the way to get a better look at the mess at the foot of the bed. Smears of mud caked into the sheet, dried. Pieces of it crack and roll away when I pull the sheet taut.
Is that?
Charlie stops speaking and pulls the corner of the top sheet from my hand, tossing it away to get a better look at the fitted sheet beneath it.
Is that blood?
I follow her eyes up the sheet toward the head of the bed. Next to the pillow is a smeared ghost of a handprint. I immediately look down at my hands. Nothing, no traces of blood or mud whatsoever. I kneel down beside the bed and place my right hand over the handprint left on the mattress. It's a perfect match, or imperfect, depending on how you look at it. I glance at Charlie, and her eyes drift away, almost as if she doesn't want to know whether or not the handprint belongs to me. The fact that it's mine only adds to the questions. We have so many questions piled up at this point, it feels as though the pile is about to collapse and bury us in everything but answers. It's probably my own blood, I say to her, or maybe I say it to myself. I try to dismiss whatever thoughts I know are developing in her head. I could have fallen outside last night. I feel like I'm making excuses for someone who isn't me. I feel like I'm making excuses for a friend of mine, this Silas guy, someone who definitely isn't me. Where were you last night? It's not a real question, just something we're both thinking. I pull at the top sheet and comforter and spread them out over the bed to hide the mess. The evidence, the clues, whatever it is, I just want to cover it up.
What does this mean?
She asks, turning to face me. She's holding a sheet of paper. I walk to her and take it out of her hands. It looks like it's been folded and unfolded so many times, there's a small, worn hole forming in the very center of it. The sentence across the page reads, "Never stop, never forget." I drop the sheet of paper on the desk, wanting it out of my hands. The paper feels like evidence, too. I don't want to touch it. I don't know what it means. I need water. It's the only thing I remember the taste of, maybe because water has no taste.
Did you write it?
She demands. How would I know? I don't like the tone in my voice. I sound aggravated. I don't want her to think I'm aggravated with her. She turns and walks swiftly to her backpack. She digs around inside and pulls out a pen, then walks back to me, shoving it in my hand.
Copy it!
She's bossy. I look down at the pen, rolling it between my fingers. I run my thumb across the embossed words printed down the side of it. Wynwood Nash Financial Group.
See if your handwriting matches,
she says. She flips the page over to the blank side and pushes it toward me. I catch her eyes, fall into them a little. But then I'm angry. I hate that she thinks of this stuff first. I hold the pen in my right hand. It doesn't feel comfortable. I switch the pen to my left hand and it fits better. I'm a lefty. I write the words from memory, and after she gets a good look at my handwriting, I flip the page back over. The handwriting is different. Mine is sharp, concise. The other is loose and uncaring. She takes the pen and rewrites the words. It's a perfect match. We both stare quietly at the paper, unsure if it even means anything. It could mean nothing. It could mean everything. The dirt on my sheets could mean everything. The blood-smeared handprint could mean everything. The fact that we can remember basic things but not people could mean everything. The clothes I'm wearing, the color of her nail polish, the camera on my desk, the photos on the wall, the clock above the door, the half-empty glass of water on the desk. I'm turning, taking it all in. It could all mean everything. Or it could all mean absolutely nothing. I don't know what to catalog in my mind and what to ignore. Maybe if I just fall asleep, I'll wake up tomorrow and be completely normal again.
I'm hungry, she says.
She's watching me. Strands of hair stand between me and a full view of her face. She's beautiful, but in a shameful way. One I'm not sure I'm supposed to appreciate. Everything about her is captivating, like the aftermath of a storm. People aren't supposed to get pleasure out of the destruction Mother Nature is capable of, but we want to stare anyway. Charlie is the devastation left in the wake of a tornado.
How do I know that?
Right now she looks calculating, staring at me like this. I want to grab my camera and take a picture of her. Something twirls in my stomach like ribbons, and I'm not sure if it's nerves or hunger or my reaction to the girl standing next to me. Let's go downstairs, I tell her. I reach for her backpack and hand it to her. I grab the camera from the dresser. We'll eat while we search our things. She walks in front of me, pausing at every picture between my room and the bottom of the stairwell. With each picture we pass, she trails her finger over my face, and my face alone. I watch as she quietly tries to figure me out through the series of photographs. I want to tell her she's wasting her time. Whoever is in those pictures, it isn't me. As soon as we reach the bottom of the stairs, our ears are assaulted by a short burst of a scream. Charlie comes to a sudden halt, and I bump into the back of her. The scream belongs to a woman standing in the doorway of the kitchen. Her eyes are wide, darting from me to Charlie, back and forth. She's clutching her heart, exhaling with relief. She's not from any of the photographs. She's plump and older, maybe in her 60s. She's wearing an apron that reads, "I put the whore in hors d'oeuvres." Her hair is pulled back, but she brushes away loose gray strands as she blows out a calming breath.
"Jesus, Silas! You scared me half to death!"
She spins and heads into the kitchen.
"You two better get back to school before your father finds out. I'm not lying for you."
Charlie is still frozen in front of me, so I place a hand against her lower back and nudge her forward. She glances at me over her shoulder.
"Do you know?"
I shake my head, cutting off her question. She's about to ask me if I know the woman in the kitchen. The answer is no. I don't know her. I don't know Charlie. I don't know the family in the photos. What I do know is the camera in my hands. I look down at it, wondering how I can remember everything there is to know about operating this camera, but I can't remember how I learned any of those things. I know how to adjust the ISO. I know how to adjust shutter speed to give a waterfall the appearance of a soft stream, or make each individual drop of water stand on its own. This camera has the ability to put the smallest detail in focus, like the curve of Charlie's hand, or the eyelashes lining her eyes, while everything else about her becomes a blur. I know that I somehow know the ins and outs of this camera better than I know what my own little brother's voice should sound like. I wrap the strap around my neck and allow the camera to dangle against my chest as I follow Charlie toward the kitchen. She's walking with purpose. So far, I've concluded that everything she does has a purpose. She wastes nothing. Every step she takes appears to be planned out before she takes it. Every word she says is necessary. Whenever her eyes land on something, she focuses on it with all of her senses, as though her eyes alone could determine how something tastes, smells, sounds, and feels. And she only looks at things when there's a reason for it. Forget the floors, the curtains, the photographs in the hall that don't have my face in them. She doesn't waste time on things that aren't of use to her. Which is why I follow her when she walks into the kitchen. I'm not sure what her purpose is right now. It's either to find out more information from the housekeeper, or she's on the hunt for food. Charlie claims a seat at the massive bar and pulls out the chair next to her and pats it without looking up at me. I take the seat and set my camera down in front of me. She drops her backpack onto the counter and begins to unzip it.
"Ezra, I'm starving. Is there anything to eat?"
My entire body swivels toward Charlie's on the stool, but it feels like my stomach is somewhere on the floor beneath me. How does she know her name? Charlie glances at me with a quick shake of her head. Calm down, she hisses. It's written right there. She points at a note, a shopping list, lying in front of us. It's a pink stationery pad, personalized, with kittens lining the bottom of the page. At the top of the personalized stationery, it reads, Things Ezra Needs, Right Meow. The woman closes the cabinet and faces Charlie.
Did you work up an appetite while you were upstairs? Because in case you weren't aware, they serve lunch at the school you should both be attending right now.
You mean right meow, I say without thinking.
Charlie spatters laughter, and then I'm laughing too. And it feels like someone finally let air into the room. Ezra, less amused, rolls her eyes. It makes me wonder if I used to be funny. I also smile because the fact that she didn't appear confused by Charlie referring to her as Ezra means Charlie was right. I reach over and run my hand along the back of Charlie's neck. She flinches when I touch her, but relaxes almost immediately when she realizes it's part of our act. We're in love, Charlie, remember? Charlie hasn't been feeling well. I brought her here so she could nap, but she hasn't eaten today. I return my attention to Ezra and smile. Do you have anything to make my girl feel better? Some soup or crackers, maybe? Ezra's expression softens when she sees the affection I'm showing Charlie. She grabs a hand towel and tosses it over her shoulder.
I'll tell you what, Char. How about I make you my grilled cheese specialty? It was your favorite back when you used to visit.
My hand stiffens against Charlie's neck. Back when you used to visit? We both look at each other, more questions clouding our eyes. Charlie nods.
Thank you, Ezra, she says.
Ezra shuts the refrigerator door with her hip and begins dropping items onto the counter. Butter, mayonnaise, bread, cheese, more cheese, Parmesan cheese. She lays a pan on the stove and ignites the flame.
I'll make you one too, Silas, Ezra says. You must have caught whatever bug Charlie has, because you haven't spoken to me this much since you hit puberty.
She chuckles after her comment. Why don't I speak to you? Charlie nudges my leg and narrows her eyes. I shouldn't have asked that. Ezra slides the knife into the butter and retrieves a slab of it. She smears it across the bread.
Oh, you know, she says, shrugging her shoulders. Little boys grow up. They become men. Housekeepers stop being Aunt Ezra and return to just being housekeepers.
Her voice is sad now. I grimace because I don't like learning about this side of myself. I don't want Charlie learning about this side of me. My eyes fall to the camera in front of me. I power it on. Charlie begins rifling through her backpack, inspecting item after item.
Uh-oh,
she says. She's holding a phone. I lean over her shoulder and look at the screen with her just as she switches the ringer to the on position. There are 7 missed calls and even more texts, all from Mom. She opens the latest text message, sent just 3 minutes ago. You have 3 minutes to call me back. I guess I didn't think about the ramifications of us ditching school. The ramifications of parents we don't even remember. We should go, I say to her. We both stand at the same time. She throws her backpack over her shoulder and I grab my camera.
Wait, Ezra says. The first sandwich is almost done.
She walks to the refrigerator and grabs 2 cans of Sprite.
This will help her stomach.
She hands me both sodas and then wraps the grilled cheese in a paper towel. Charlie is already waiting at the front door. Just as I'm about to walk away from Ezra, she squeezes my wrist. I face her again, and her eyes move from Charlie to me.
It's good to see her back here,
Ezra says softly.
I've been worried how everything between both your fathers might have affected the two of you. You've loved that girl since before you could walk.
I stare at her, not sure how to process all the information I just received. Before I could walk, huh? She smiles like she has one of my secrets. I want it back.
Silas,
Charlie says. I shoot a quick smile at Ezra and head for Charlie. As soon as I reach the front door, the shrill ring on her phone startles her and it falls from her hands, straight to the floor. She kneels to pick it up. "It's her," she says, standing. "What should I do?" I open the door and urge her outside by her elbow. Once the door is shut, I face her again. The phone is on its third ring. "You should answer it." She stares at the phone, her fingers gripping tightly around it. She doesn't answer it, so I reach down and swipe right to answer. She crinkles up her nose and glares at me as she brings it to her ear. "Hello?" We begin walking to the car, but I listen quietly at the broken phrases coming through her phone. "You know better," and "skip school," and "how could you?" The words continue to come out of her phone until we're both seated in my car with the door shut. I start the car and the woman's voice grows quiet for several seconds. Suddenly, the voice is blaring through the speakers of my car. Bluetooth. I remember what Bluetooth is. I place the drinks and sandwich on the center console and begin to back out of the driveway. Charlie still hasn't had a chance to respond to her mother, but she rolls her eyes when I look at her. "Mom," Charlie says flatly, attempting to interrupt her. "Mom, I'm on my way home. Silas is taking me to my car." There is a long silence that follows Charlie's words, and somehow her mother is much more intimidating when words aren't being yelled through the phone. When she does begin speaking again, her words come out slow and over-enunciated.
"Please tell me you did not allow that family to buy you a car."
Our eyes meet and Charlie mouths the word "shit."
No, I meant Silas is bringing me home. Be there in a few minutes."
Charlie fumbles with the phone in her hands, attempting to return to a screen that will allow her to end the call. I press the disconnect button on the steering wheel and end it for her. She inhales slowly, turning to face her window. When she exhales, a small circle of fog appears against the window near her mouth.
"Silas."
She faces me and arches a brow.
"I think my mother may be a bitch."
I laugh, but offer no reassurance. I agree with her. We're both quiet for several miles. I repeat my brief conversation with Ezra over and over in my head. I'm unable to push the scene out of my head, and she's not even my parent. I can't imagine what Charlie must be feeling right now after speaking to her actual mother. I think both of us have had the reassurance in the backs of our minds that once we came in contact with someone as close to us as our parents, it would trigger our memory. I can tell by Charlie's reaction that she didn't recognize a single thing about the woman she spoke to on the phone.
"I don't have a car," she says quietly.
I look over at her and she's drawing a cross with her fingertip on the fogged-up window.
"I'm 17. I wonder why I don't have a car."
As soon as she mentions the car, I remember that I'm still driving in the direction of the school rather than wherever I need to be taking her.
"Do you happen to know where you live, Charlie?"
Her eyes swing to mine, and in a split second the confusion on her face is overcome by clarity. It's fascinating how easily I can read her expressions now in comparison to earlier this morning. Her eyes are like two open books, and I suddenly want to devour every page. She pulls her wallet from her backpack and reads the address from her driver's license.
"If you pull over, we can put it in the GPS," she says.
I push the navigation button. "These cars are made in London. You don't have to idle to program an address into the GPS." I begin to enter her street number and I feel her watching me. I don't even have to see her eyes to know they're overflowing with suspicion. I shake my head before she even asks the question. "No, I don't know how I knew that." Once the address is entered, I turn the car around and begin to head in the direction of her house. We're 7 miles away. She opens both sodas and tears the sandwich in half, handing me part of it. We drive 6 miles without speaking. I want to reach over and grab her hand to comfort her. I want to say something reassuring to her. If this were yesterday, I'm sure I would have done that without a second thought. But it's not yesterday, it's today, and Charlie and I are complete strangers today. On the 7th and final mile, she speaks, but all she says is, That was a really good grilled cheese. Make sure you tell Ezra I said so. I slow down. I drive well below the speed limit until we reach her street, and then I stop as soon as I turn onto the road. She's staring out her window.